The Copper Kettle's bathhouse was plainly furnished, but well-built and fully equipped. Corus spent the better part of an hour immersed up to the neck, eyes half-closed in drowsy content as steaming water soaked the ache out of his muscles. He'd endured more time on horseback, or in one of the bouncing, jouncing stagecoaches that bounded between posting houses on the more heavily traveled stretches, over the past few months than in his entire previous existence, and he felt every weary mile of it deep in his bones. To be fair, the high roads here in Howard were far better designed, built, and maintained than their ostensible counterparts in Coruscant had ever been. Broad, stone-paved, with well-designed drainage and solid bridges, they'd made it possible for him to maintain an average of just over 100 miles a day. He could never have done that on Coruscantian roads, and to be honest, he wished he hadn't had to do it on Howard's roads either. The fact that it was possible didn't make it anything remotely like pleasant, and the Earl's lifetime preference for sea travel had been amply reconfirmed over the month since his departure from Talkeira. Of course, that had been the easy part of his projected journey, he reminded himself glumly as he hoisted himself out of the water at last and reached for the towel which had been warming in front of the huge tiled stove that heated the bathhouse. The Gulf of Dolar in October was about as miserable a stretch of seawater as anyone could ever hope to find. And while Corus had formed a high initial impression of Captain Euthane's competence, Ice Lizard was a galley, not a galleon. She was shallow draft, low slung, and sleek, and it was obvious to the Earl's experienced eye that she was going to be Shan Wei's own bitch in a seaway. Assuming they survived the passage of the Gulf, which seemed at least an even bet, if Captain Euthane proved as skilled as Corus thought he was, there was the delightful prospect of another 1,300 miles of overland travel, this time through the belly-deep snows of November, just to reach the southern shores of Lake Pei. And then there was the even more delightful prospect of the 400-mile trip across the lake, which would undoubtedly be frozen over by the time he got there, which, in turn, meant he would have to make the entire trip, oh joy, by ice boat. That experience, he had no doubt, would make Ice Lizard look exactly like the fine cruise ship Euthane had assured him she wasn't. "It's a good thing you're not 50 yet, Philip," he told himself glumly as he finished toweling off and reached for the linen drawers Sea Blanket had thoughtfully placed to warm in front of the stove. "You'll probably survive. It's a good thing you made sure your will was in order ahead of time. But you'll probably survive. Until you actually get to Zion, at least." And that was the crux of the matter, really, wasn't it? What was going to happen once he reached Zion and the temple? The fact that the writ summoning him had been signed by the Grand Inquisitor as well, not just the Chancellor, hadn't exactly put his mind at ease. Not surprisingly, he supposed, since he rather doubted it had been intended to do anything of the sort. Trenaire and Clinton couldn't possibly see Diven as anything more than a potentially useful pawn. Someday, if he could finally somehow reach the chessboard's final file, he might be elevated, converted into something more valuable than that. But Diven Dakin was only a very little boy when all was said, and Clinton, at least, would never forget for a moment that pawns were meant to be sacrificed. Corus had done his best to reassure Iris, and he knew the princess far too well to serve up comforting lies in the effort. In the Earl's opinion, the girl was even smarter than her father had been, and she wasn't afraid to use the wit God and the archangels had given her. She had all her father's ability to carry a grudge until it died of old age, then have it stuffed and mounted someplace where she could admire it at regular intervals, but, so far at least, she'd usually shown a fair amount of discretion in choosing which grudges to hold. That might well change, indeed might already have changed, given how her world had been shattered into topsy-turvy ruin in the last year or so. But despite her youth, she was just as capable as Corus himself when it came to reading the political wind, recognizing the storm clouds gathering about her younger brother. That was why he'd told her the absolute truth when he'd said he doubted the group of four had any immediate plans for how they might most profitably utilize Diven. Yet, sooner or later, they would have plans, and that was the reason they'd decided to drag him all these thousands of miles through a mainland winter. When the time came, they would want to be certain Philip Osgood understood his place, recognized his true masters with a clear vision, unblinkered by any lingering, misplaced loyalty to the House of Dakin. They intended to underscore that to him, and to see him for themselves form their own judgment of him. And if that judgment proved unfavorable, they would remove him from his position as Diven's and Iris's guardian. If he was quite unreasonably lucky, he might even survive the removal rather than be quietly and efficiently disappeared. At the moment, he'd give odds of, at least 1 in 50 that he would. "Well, Philip, my boy," he thought, slipping into an embroidered steel thistle silk shirt, "you'll just have to see that they form a favorable opinion, won't you? Shouldn't be all that hard. Not for an experienced, conniving liar such as yourself. All you have to do is keep any of them from getting close enough to figure out what you really think. How hard can it be?"